From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. People feel strongly about curse words. Some love to use them. They feel like they're just the right way of expressing frustration or triumph. Some hate them. In some cases, for moral reasons, they're profane and they're dirty. Some people think that those who swear have a weak vocabulary and they just lack the creativity to find a better word. But wherever you are on the question of swear words, you've got to admit they're powerful. Benjamin Bergen says just saying them or hearing them has a physical effect on people. Bergen is a cognitive scientist. He studies swear words, and he's written a book called What the F. He'll join us today to talk about what studying profanity teaches us about where language gets its power to shape our minds and the world. Don't worry, we've bleeped the swears, so you can join us after the news.
Support for Radio West comes from thousands of sustainers, listeners just like you who give ongoing monthly donations to help pay for the public radio shows they rely on. Show your love for Radio West by becoming a sustainer, starting at just $5 a month at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So first thing, a disclaimer or a quick note to reassure some of you. We've bleeped out the curse words in the show today, and there were a lot of them. That's what the show is about, these words. That is how swear words work, where they come from, what makes a swear word, you know, the effect they have on us. So we've bleeped out these taboo words because we have to, but also because some of the words are rough. And not just the F word or the C word, but the N word. That's a tough one to say out loud. And let's also acknowledge bleeping the words can only do so much. So if you're really sensitive to this kind of thing, or if you're with your kids, you may want to skip this show altogether. Benjamin Bergen is our guest throughout the hour today. He's written a book called What the F. Bergen is a cognitive scientist. He's a professor at the University of California, San Diego, and he studies language. It turns out curse words, taboo words, are the perfect vehicle to explore the mechanics of language and how language is processed in our brains. We spoke with him earlier this week, so we would have enough time to do some bleeping. First thing I asked was, does he curse?
I do, in my normal life. Not as much when I'm lecturing in class.
Right, okay, good. And have you always cursed?
I mean, I suppose my first word wasn't a curse word.
Yeah.
But no, early in childhood, I lived in a household, like many households, where swearing was not permitted. And so I learned lessons early on that this was not an appropriate activity. And I think that's probably where I learned that this was a really fun thing to do and something that I wanted to explore in my own time.
You say in some ways, you describe it at one point in the book, that the book is in some way kind of a love letter to profanity. You say you have this special affection for profanity. Describe that. Explain that.
Well, language can do lots of different things. And usually when we think about language as a cognitive device, we consider the rational explanation of ideas and communication of thoughts through time and space that it affords us and not other animals. And that's really cool. But profanity does something slightly different. It acts as a signal to other members of the species that says, I'm experiencing a strong emotional state right now. Yeah. Or I want you to feel something right now, whether I want you to laugh or I want you to like me, I want you to think I'm powerful. And other language just doesn't have the capacity to do that. And so I find profanity really fascinating as an object of study, because for the most part, we just don't understand the nuances of exactly how it does all of those magical things that it can do.
I mean, you can't write a book like this and not just come right out and spell out the words. And you can't really have an interview about this subject without coming right out and saying the words. So we've decided to record this program beforehand and bleep the words rather than just kind of dance around them. And you have something to say about the effectiveness of bleeping words, by the way, which we'll come back to a little bit later. But sort of as this respectable professor, talk about how you approached a subject like this where you are incredibly candid and straightforward. I mean, you must have approached this with a little bit of trepidation. I mean, people have been fired for using these words in lectures.
That's right. Well, there are certain words that even someone like me who, you know, has a, as you said, a soft spot in his heart for swearing, there are certain words that I just don't like to say. slurs in particular, ethnic slurs, racial slurs, sexist, homophobic slurs. Those don't feel really good to me. On the other hand, I guess I feel like my job as a cognitive scientist, right? That's what I do. I study language and the brain. I guess my job is to consider objectively the full panoply of human behavior and human experience. And so in the same way that maybe the Kinsey report in the 40s laid bare human sexuality by just describing it, just saying what it was objectively, I guess I feel like in the book and then in my classes when I talk about profanity, I just want to take away some of the stigma, the taboo about these behaviors by just stating what they are and describing it.
Yeah. Which we'll do. We'll come right out, say the words today. But I have to say, I curse all the time. And I resist language bans and censorship, you know, on the principles of free speech. But there are some words that, as I was sort of preparing for this conversation, I felt like I couldn't really bring myself to say, even though I think I will, but like the C word and the N word in particular, which we won't be referring to as the C word or the N word later, but they seem so packed with baggage and so fraught that they're really hard to just come out and say, I think.
Well, there's science on this, right? Yeah. So if you ask people, particularly young American English speakers, to rate how offensive individual words are, those words are at the top of the list. Yeah. And in fact, words that we usually think of as the worst words of the language, a word like fuck, doesn't even show up until number 13 or 14 on the list.
Yeah.
So we know that young people really find these slurs offensive, and there's science showing why they should. I mean, these words do cause harm. Overhearing them leads people to act in a more discriminatory manner towards members of the marginalized groups, and being called by these words, although we don't really have the causal studies that could tell us this for sure, it seems to correlate with increased depression, anxiety in kids when they're called by, for example, homophobic slurs. So people seem to know that there are words that are hard to use in positive ways. They can be used in positive ways, even those words, but they tend not to be as much.
Maybe we should define our terms and sort of jump in. I guess we need to put curse words in their sort of proper categories, which you do, and it kind of brings us to the heading for chapter one. Holy shit. Let's get these into some categories. Let's start with holy. The word profanity means, as you explain in the book, outside the temple. So it's about the idea of desecrating the holy. So holy is a category. Take us through some of those.
Yeah, there are lots of words that are drawn from religious terminology that enter into the profane lexicon for exactly that reason. It's sacrilegious to say things like Jesus Christ or Holy Christ. And in the history of English, these at one point were our most offensive terms. Many of them have disappeared. So we don't say zounds anymore or gadzooks anymore. Those at one time referred to God's wounds and God's eyes. But over the course of time, perhaps with decreasing religiosity, we've sort of shifted away from those as the worst words of the language, where other languages and cultures still have them as among their most offensive terms.
The second place where English and profanity anyway comes from is relating to sex and sexual acts. So the heading, I guess it seems pretty obvious, but
that one's hard to miss.
Yeah.
you see this across languages, right? So in Cantonese, the worst words, in Russian, the worst words, in many languages, the most offensive words are words that relate to this particular taboo. I mean, what we're discovering is that each of these four categories is a taboo type of human experience.
Yeah.
The reason that language about sexuality becomes taboo is that sexuality is taboo. That's why there are certain places and not others that we engage in sexual activity. So yes, there's language describing sex, the act of performing, various different sorts of sex acts, the body parts involved in those sex acts, the people who perform them. So in many languages, sexual deviance or people who perform deviant sexual acts like prostitutes, motherfucker, that kind of thing, those are profane words.
and bodily functions, I guess. Is this pretty common across cultures?
Yeah, quite common. Yeah, things that come out of your body, the parts that they come out of, the things that you use to take care of those body parts. That's quite common across languages. I don't really know of languages in which that's the strongest source of profanity, but certainly in languages like English and German, many others, there's lots of bodily function related language that is, if not the most profane, relatively profane.
Yeah. Germans use the word shit a lot, or references of it. That was interesting to me.
They do scheiße and Arsch, which is ass. Those are profane words. They're not super vulgar, though, right. At least not nowadays. It's possible that our belief that these are really bad words comes from 100-year-old movies. When I ask German speakers, they don't seem to think that these are the worst words in the language.
We mentioned slurs, like for example, and we'll talk about that. That's another one of those categories. But this was interesting, too. And maybe we could just briefly mention that there are a few more categories. And I just wanted to mention one of them is like references to animals, like dog. Was interesting.
Right. Yeah, bitch is an example of that, actually.
Yeah.
Ass.
Yeah. And disease. That surprised me.
Well, remember, the rule is that if things are taboo in human experience, those words might come to be taboo. And death and disease are obviously very taboo. So in a language like Dutch, some of the strongest profanities are just names for diseases, like tuberculosis and cancer.
Gosh.
And ostensibly, according to Dutch speakers, who have told me these things, that the stronger profanities are the diseases that are more deadly.
Okay, so let's you point out that the holy fucking shit principle, as you describe it, isn't just about English, it's about language, which is to say that the forces that make words profane also happen in other cultures.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's not like we can say a particular word is going to be profane in every language,
right.
But we can say with pretty confident certainty that if a language has taboos about specific words, if a language decides, a culture decides, that in this language there are going to be some words that we decide are the bad ones, the ones that we don't want to say around kids, we don't want to hear from kids, we don't want to say in formal situations, we don't want to hear over the public airwaves, they're going to be drawn from those particular categories of human experience.
The French, this was interesting, also, sort of the cultural idiosyncrasies that play a role in shaping how profanity in a language plays out. The French, and I guess this makes sense, the French are less uptight about profanity, I guess.
Yeah, the strongest words in continental French, so foutre, which is basically like our F word, or putain, which means whore, but is used very much like the F word is in English, is just sort of an everyday interjection. Those are heard quite commonly. And in fact, if you weren't paying close attention, you might not even know that they were bad words. And notice that this is not something about the French language per se. This is something about French culture, because as soon as we turn to Quebec, where French is also spoken, we find that there are very strong profanities in Quebecois French. It's just not the same ones.
No. It's they have the holy ones.
That's right. They have these religious terms like tabarnak, which is tabernacle, or calice, which is chalice. These Catholic liturgical terms that have come to be the strongest swears that they have.
Japan is interesting. They have ways, you say in the book, that of speaking that are stronger than others. But you say Japanese lacks that core feature of what makes profanity so powerful. Talk about Japanese profanity, or the lack of Japanese profanity.
We have this idea that there are just bad words. And we might not always agree on exactly which ones they are, but there's this sort of cultural setting that we have in the West that says these words are bad. Maybe they're harmful. Maybe they're inappropriate. Maybe they index a fetid mind. But that doesn't seem to exist in Japan. There's not the same concept that, you know, these particular words with these particular sounds spelled in this particular way are just the bad ones. So you don't see words that are sort of the equivalent of shit or fuck or asshole. You don't see those being bleeped on television. They don't elicit the same sort of physiological reactions. They're just not that bad. And so what you find is that Japanese speakers, when they learn a new language, in particular English or Spanish, a language that affords these new linguistic adventures, they're oftentimes quite fascinated with this phenomenon and try to explore it. Like, what is this thing that you guys, why are you so worried about these words?
Yeah. One of the things you say is that for centuries, really, people who would study language, study linguistics, didn't really get close to the idea of profanity. And I guess it makes sense if these are such taboo words. But do you sense that's changing? You say that there's a cabal of researchers working on this subject, and they're mostly careful, I guess, mostly out of the public eye, it seems like, right now. But do you sense that taboo, at least related to studying this subject, is changing?
I think it is. I think that it's become more acceptable, at least for those run-of-the-mill profanities, the George Carlin profanities, let's call them, ones that you can't see on television. Those seem to be entering into scientific discourse more and more. But there's also been some pushback about the slurs.
Right.
So especially on college campuses, you see this idea that particular words might require trigger warnings, that they might not be appropriate for safe spaces. And I think there's an interesting change happening now culturally, a generational change. When you look at millennials and whatever my freshmen are, they don't find those traditional four-letter words to be that bad. And they're interested in exploring them and understanding why their parents think they're so bad. They hear them all the time, right? They wake up and, you know, if they're on Twitter, they see f*** 100 times before breakfast. But the slurs, they really take to heart. And I think that this is part of, you know, this is the internet giveth and the internet taketh away, right? So they... Yeah, they see swear words all the time, and that kind of inures them to them. They don't really see what's so bad about the run-of-the-mill swear words. But they also see, through their social connections, more visibility in people who are hurt by slurs. So there's this movement now to reject the word retard, which in my childhood, I'm 40 years old, in my childhood was, you know, it was an insult, but certainly wasn't judged to be among the top 10 worst words of the language. And probably it's something that I could have gotten away with saying at home. And now it's not even close.
Right.
So a large part of that seems to be, if you ask young adults, it seems to come from their Facebook history and their Twitter history of seeing videos produced by people saying things like, my brother has Down syndrome. Yeah. And when I hear someone calling him a retard, that hurts a lot. I don't like to hear that, and it hurts my brother, and I want to protect him. And I think that millennials and younger Americans really get it. And so the interesting place that we're at now is that they feel that these words are very strong, and their impulse is to do exactly what previous generations did, which is to censor them, right? Not allow them in public discourse. And that's probably going to have the very same consequence that censorship always has, which is that it's going to make those words more powerful, more taboo, and they're going to hurt more because of it.
What makes a word a profanity? As you put it in the book, shit is more profane than poop. F*** is profane. Copulate isn't. So why would that be?
Well, we know that where they come from makes a difference, the holy f***ing shit principle. But that's not deterministic, right? There are ways to talk about defecation with children, and there are ways to talk about it with your doctor, and neither of those is profane. One thing that seems to contribute is the sound structure of the word. So a word like f*** people report, or c***, people think that those words not only are bad, but just sound really powerful. They sound hurtful, or they sound emotional. And if you look at the distribution of how profane words sound in English compared to other words, you find that they do tend to share this particular pattern, which is that they tend to be one syllable long, like those words, and they tend to have lots of consonants, particularly at the end, and particularly these hard stop consonants like t and ka and pa.
And
that seems to be something that we've learned about how English profanity is organized, so that when we make up new profane words, we tend to gravitate towards those same patterns. So if you watched Battlestar Galactica, the new one, they made up a new swear word, which was frack, right? And frack sounds bad, even though it's not. It also may be responsible for the evolution of new words like tard and milf, which are becoming these profane words that that have that same sound structure, one syllable with consonants at the end.
And of course, as you point out, in English profanity anyway, it's more likely that these are actual, we call them four-letter words, but it turns out a lot of them, an amazing number actually, are just that, four letters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are more that are four letters than you'd expect by chance. Also more that are three and five letters. Yeah. That's how we know it's about the sound per se. And surprisingly, also more that are eight letters, which makes sense, of course, when you stack up two four-letter words.
It's Benjamin Bergen. He's a professor of cognitive science at the University of California, San Diego. His book is What the F? What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, and Ourselves. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Let me repeat a disclaimer about the show today. We're talking about curse words, and we've bleeped all the big ones. But if you don't want to hear even the bleeped version of some pretty rough language, then you should rethink listening to this show. Benjamin Bergen is our guest today. We're talking about his book, What the F?, which explores what swearing tells us about language and about how we process these words in our brains. One of the things that you write about is gestures, which do seem to have a kind of clear motivation, like our arms, our hands, our shifting eyes. Gestures, of course, can replace words, but how did they come into play in terms of profanity? You write about these in the book, and maybe we should start with the most obvious one, the bird, the finger. What do we know about about giving someone the bird? I mean, it used to mean penis. I didn't realize that. It doesn't really anymore, but it's still a profanity. So how do hand gestures fit in?
Right. Well, we know that there are lots of ways to communicate aside from flapping your vocal cords. And the head and eyes, torso, arms, you can even gesture with your feet, right, if your hands are full. So people are gesturing all the time. We know that they gesture even when it wouldn't help at all. So people gesture when they're talking to people who are blind, when they're talking to infants who can't see, when they're talking on the telephone. I'm gesturing right now.
Yeah.
And so we know this is something that we really prefer to do when we're communicating. And profane gestures are a special class because they, like profane words, do that emotional work. We know that when someone holds up the middle finger as opposed to a control finger, like the index finger, for example, that this leads them to interpret other people's actions as being more aggressive. We know that when a person observes the middle finger, they interpret that person as being aggressive in their behavior. And this wouldn't surprise you because, of course, you have a long history in your life of seeing people holding up that particular finger, say, on the highway or in other circumstances where social relations are breaking down. But you're right. It's a gesture that's been around for thousands of years. The ancient Greeks had it. The Romans borrowed it along with lots of cultural stuff. They called it digitus impudicus, the impudent finger. And you're right that originally we know that it was a phallic symbol because in ancient Greek plays, it's juxtaposed with characters waggling their penises at one another. So it's pretty obvious where it comes from. Nowadays, it doesn't seem to have any trace of that phallic association. It's just used for this purpose of denigrating, showing disdain for someone, and maybe activating some aggression.
Gestures and signs, you point out in the book, are less arbitrary than spoken language. So what about profanity expressed in sign language? Like, what does that tell us about all of this?
Well, signs and signed languages are these symbols that you have to learn. They're not just pantomime. Signed languages are, of course, real, fully formed communicative systems that are capable of expressing absolutely any human thought, including, I don't like you, I want you to know it, I'm angry.
Yeah.
The signs in signed languages, so American Sign Language is the sign language used most in the United States. They have some cultural influence from our gestures. So the middle finger means the middle finger in American Sign Language. But they have many other signs that are themselves offensive, profane. They do all the same things that profane words do. They describe sex, social groups, and so on. Some of their most offensive words are body part terms. There's one sign in American Sign Language I saw that I thought was really interesting. It combines the sign for think and the sign for hearing person. Yes, mm-hmm. There's a sign for hearing people, of course. And this is a pretty offensive slur. It means you think like a hearing person, and that's a really bad thing in context. So the difference, of course, is that these signs do look a little bit more like, in some cases, what they mean than words of a spoken language sound like what they mean. So think like a hearing person is placed on the forehead where thinking happens. Mm-hmm. And the sign for pussy is iconically representing using the hands the shape of a vagina. Yeah. So there's a lot more, it's a lot harder to ignore the source of this terminology in a signed language. It just looks like what it means.
What happens to our bodies when we say a taboo word? What physical response is there?
Well, when we say or hear a taboo word, there's this whole suite of physiological reactions. The heart rate increases, blood pressure increases, blood flows to the extremities, your palms start sweating, your pupils dilate, adrenaline starts flowing. And this all appears to be part of a suite of responses coordinated by the sympathetic nervous system that we call colloquially the fight or flight response. And we know that this probably comes from early childhood experiences or lifelong experiences in which these words evoked some strong emotional reaction. We saw our parents freak out or get angry when we used those words. We saw adults get angry and then use those words, and we associate those emotional experiences with the words. The way that brains work is to hard code connections between experiences, including emotional ones and linguistic ones. Yeah. And the consequence of this physiological arousal that we get from profane words is that we can interpret our emotional state, our heightened emotional reaction, in a variety of ways in different contexts. So sometimes that heightened emotional response leads us to be able to endure pain. So if you put someone in a laboratory experiment, have them immerse their hand in very, very cold water, have them swear, they can endure it for about 50% longer than if they weren't swearing. In other contexts, we might interpret that emotional arousal, that physical state of arousal, as being sexual arousal.
Yeah. Yeah.
In other contexts, we might interpret it as anger, and so on. The interplay of our physiological reaction with our interpretation of the context produces our interpreted emotion that we think that our body is telling us we're having.
You mentioned the linguist Timothy Jay, who writes about profanity in language. He talks about this cathartic benefit to profanity. Like that. What does he mean? That it sort of gives kind of what you were talking about, some kind of relief almost.
There's an idea that you can alleviate strong negative emotional experiences through profanity. The one case that we really know about is pain, is the increased endurance of pain when people are swearing compared to not. We don't really know from experimental science about all the other things that people anecdotally believe they might get from profanity. So that includes decreasing stress. So for example, if I was nervous about this interview beforehand, I might have let loose a string of profanities that might have led me to believe that I could perform better on mic. Other people think that profanity might lead to alleviation of anger. So if I'm really angry at someone, I gave the example of road rage, but let's say I'm really angry at someone on the road and I swear or I use the middle finger. Might that decrease the likelihood that subsequently I'll do something physically aggressive, using the car, for example? We just don't have data on that It's something that I'm exploring in my lab right now, but I'll have to talk to you next year.
You know, there's that scene in the film The King's Speech where the linguist who's helping the king, who has a stammer, who stutters, to be able to speak more clearly. And he has them go through this technique of cursing, saying, you know, or whatever, as a way of just kind of distracting him a bit so he's not thinking so much, almost like a reflex. I'm not sure if you've thought much about that particular scene or how it works. How does it work in that sense? Is it being a kind of reflex almost?
Sure. Well, it can be reflexive. You've got kind of two ways you can produce profanity, two pathways in the brain, actually. The first is you can rationally, coldly, calculatingly decide, I'm going to say the word fuck.
Yeah.
And that runs through the normal pathways, usually in the left hemisphere of the brain. These are circuits that are evolutionarily new, that we know are specialized for language in humans and not in other animals. And then there's this second pathway that we seem to share in common with other primates, other mammals, maybe even other vertebrates, that we all use, including all those other animals, to vocalize emotional experiences. So when a vervet monkey screeches because it sees a predator, say a snake or an eagle, and another vervet hears that and understands that there is danger and reacts appropriately, jumping out of the way or hiding in the bushes or whatever it is, that communicative act uses this different circuitry. Now, this different circuitry doesn't live in the new cerebral cortex that we think of as the locus of all rational, intelligent, complex, abstract thought that humans can do. It lives deep in the core of the brain, in emotion centers that have the main job of deciding what emotion I'm experiencing and what action I should perform, and importantly, what actions I should not perform, given that I have that emotional experience. And this second pathway can produce profanity. It's the source of profanity when we, you know, when we stub our toes or hammer our thumbs, when a football team surprisingly scores a touchdown to something that's rare here in San Diego. Where whatever the emotional experience is, when it's a strong, transient emotional experience that sort of overwhelms our usual internal sensors, then this system, this secondary system, this old system, this vertebrate system, spits out these reflexive profanities. And so producing those words as a reflex, I've heard from other people, can be quite therapeutic. We don't really have a systematic study of this. Mm. But I was contacted by a woman in Florida who told me about her mother who suffered from severe dementia and had lost pretty much all of her language functions, like many people do when they have damage to these new cerebral language centers. And this is a very disempowering type of experience. When you lose all of your language, when you have aphasia, you don't have control over the mere ability to communicate. What this woman told me was that her mother gained, apparently, great satisfaction from swear therapy. This is something that she made up herself. She would take her mom out of the nursing home that she was living in, out into the park, out to the other side where no one could hear them.
Right.
And she would say, "Mom, do you want to swear now?" And her mom would want to swear now. And she would just let loose with the string of the filthiest. This is an 80-year-old woman, right?
Awesome.
The filthiest expletives that you could possibly imagine. And she reported that this was the one time that her mom seemed to feel empowered, agentive. You know, she had control. She could do something. She could do something powerful. She could be a powerful person in those moments. So I'm not surprised that some people find that there are cases where swearing does really help them along when the rest of language is failing them.
Let's talk about a chapter you've labeled F-ing Grammar, which explores how grammar, I guess grammar changes when you throw profanity in the mix. And you as a professor would, you diagram this sentence. There's too much homework in this F-ing class. Talk about grammar and how that's reflected in this particular sentence that you write about.
So we like to think that the objective of science is to get the broadest generalizations possible,
right?
In physics, you want a grand unifying theory of everything. In language, we also want a maximally general theory of how the structure of sentences works. And that would be a general theory of grammar. And so we like to find these general rules, like a sentence has to have a subject. A sentence has to have a predicate, and that predicate has to have a verb. The problem is that profanity breaks the rules. So in that particular sentence, you can stick that particular word, f***ing, into lots and lots of different places in the sentence.
Right.
There's too much homework in this class. There's too much homework in this class. There's too much homework in this class. There's you could go on. And there aren't other words that can do the same multiplicity of duties.
Yep.
It's just a special case. The same is true of this very common profane expression, f*** you, which is a sentence that doesn't have a subject. There's no one doing the reported act. I guess we think that implicitly, maybe it's you. You're the subject of f*** in f*** you. But actually, a grammarian will tell you that you can't be the subject of f*** you, because if it were, then it would be f*** yourself.
Right.
Which does have a subject. We know that you isn't the subject. In fact, we can be pretty confident that there's no subject at all in that sentence. And this is as big a finding for the study of grammar, which is the human ability to create new sentences. It's kind of a big deal. This is as big a finding as discovering a new phylum in biology would be, right? Because this is an entirely different class of human expression that doesn't work the same way. It doesn't have a subject like the rest of language does. And so what we learn is that maybe there are different kinds of grammar for the different uses that we want to put language to.
It's so interesting because I don't give a f*** makes sense. I don't give you a f*** makes no sense. Or jack s***. you don't know jack s***. Like, that shouldn't make sense, but we've put it together. We've filled in the gaps. And I guess that's in some ways how profanity works.
We use profanity for very specific function. So now we're getting into the kind of litany of things that you want to do with profanity. You want to dismiss. That's what jack shit does. You want to demean. That's what fuck you does. You want to express your intense dislike for a particular thing. That's what fucking does in there's too much homework in this fucking class. These specific emotional purposes come with their own particular language. And we learn that to do this job, to express my disdain for you now in this moment, all I have to do is use these two words, and grammar be damned.
It's Benjamin Bergen, a professor of cognitive science at the University of California, San Diego. We recorded this conversation earlier in the week. His book is What the F? What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, and Ourselves. We'll take another break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back to our conversation with the cognitive scientist Benjamin Bergen. We're discussing his book about curse words called What the F? One of the questions that comes up is, does hearing profanity do some kind of psychic damage to kids? In the book, you say it turns out there isn't really any evidence of that.
Yeah. Now, to be clear, no one has done the controlled blind studies, right? No one has gone in and just sworn at kids for 5 years and seen how that turns out.
Yeah.
There's reason to believe that that particular ways of using profanity and language in general could very well cause harm to kids. So exposure to abuse, verbal abuse, so that includes telling a child that he or she is worthless, threatening the child, using slurs to denigrate the child based on some social group affiliation. Those are clearly things that, at least in correlational studies, have been found to correlate with decreasing well-being in children. And that includes more aggression towards other children, more depression, more anxiety, feelings of separation and detachment from school. There's lots of bad stuff that correlates with that type of language, with verbal abuse in all of its forms. There's no evidence, though, that profanity makes it worse, or for that matter, that profanity in isolation, used for all the positive things that profanity is sometimes actually statistically is most frequently used for, that those positive uses of profanity could cause harm. So people use profanity. If you look at the studies you mentioned, Tim Jay earlier, he's conducted the largest ever study, tens of thousands of observations of people using profanity in the real world. For the most part, these are used for pro-social functions, to express excitement or to be funny, to show social affiliation, to show how you're accessible or powerful. And in general, there's never been any evidence shown that this type of profanity use has any consequences whatsoever on kids.
Is profanity, you sometimes hear this from your folks when you're a kid, that it's a reflection of a weak vocabulary, that you lack creativity, so you just come up with an easy word. A curse word is an easy word. What do you say about that?
Well, we have a little bit of experimental data on this, not from kids, but as soon as they become not kids and we can study them at the university,
right.
We can ask them ethically, yeah. Right? We can do things like ask them, okay, 30 seconds, say all the profane words you can go. And we can look to see whether the ones who have more ease with profanity are different from the ones who have less ease with profanity. And it turns out that the ones who have the biggest profane vocabularies also have the biggest general vocabularies. Now, we don't know whether there's a causal effect there, right? I don't know whether engaging with profanity leads you to therefore be more open-minded and more interested in language in general. It could be true. Or whether it just happens to be the case that people who, as kids, like to explore language more, are more interested in language, have more of an aptitude for language, whether they are able to learn more of language in all of its manifestations, including profanity. We don't know if it's causal or correlated, but it's certainly not the case that the biggest swearers have the most stunted vocabularies. It's at least the opposite.
You take on I want to get to this point we were talking about earlier, and that is the role of slurs, which are different. It's a different category, obviously. You write about censorship, whether censorship works. I mean, it works in the sense that it does limit the exposure on TV and radio because the government censors this kind of thing. That's why we're bleeping these words today. But does censorship make less profanity in the world, or does it limit its effect? You say maybe not, but slurs seem to be an exception to that. And you write about, there's a whole chapter on this where you talk about words like "fat" or "nigger," that they lead people to treat the people who they're using those words for as less than human. It even makes some people physically retreat from these people when those slurs are used. Say something about that, if you would.
There's been some work in social psychology on this, the idea that even subconscious exposure to a slur can change the way that you think about and treat a member of the denigrated group. So you're right. If you expose someone to a homophobic slur unconsciously, they don't even know it blinked so fast on the screen that they didn't even apprehend it consciously. They not only slide their chair farther away from a person who they believe is homosexual, they also make different decisions about how government resources should be allocated. So if you ask them how much should the government spend on these different programs, they decide if they were primed with a homophobic slur, as compared with a control word like homosexual, they decide that less money should go to AIDS HIV prevention, which could be interpreted as being something that would be used by and useful for homosexual people. Mm-hmm. So there's a shift in people's attitudes towards people who are called by slurs. And this is probably not going to go away simply by censorship. What we know about censorship is that censorship mostly doesn't work because people know exactly what words were being referred to. I guess your listeners can be the judges of that if they know what words we meant as we went.
Oh man, they'll know. They'll so know. Anyway, keep going.
Yeah, I mean, you know what words were expressed. It's not that it's going to keep children from learning the words, because they don't learn those words from the television. They learn those words from kids with older siblings. They learn them on the playground. So the kids aren't going to not learn those words. Adults aren't going to not know what words were said that were bleeped out or blanked out or whatever. And they're not going to fail to have those consequences. In fact, the censorship, if anything, it just intensifies the belief that these are powerful words. There's something about these words per se. They have this magic stuff that makes people hurt, that causes harm to people. And not censoring them at all also poses its own challenges, right? If they do cause harm, then free use of the terms could, in fact, cause harm. So we're sort of in a double bind with respect to these strongest profanities.
You were talking about earlier how there's this sort of transition going on in profanity. Vulgar sexual terms like f*** have become more acceptable, whereas slurs have become kind of unspeakable. And one of the things you write about is that people should get more informed about how these words work, like what a slur means, where it comes from. Like, you know, the words gypped and tarred. I mean, some people don't really even think about them. They just sort of say them. They're not necessarily thinking about a disabled person, or they're not necessarily thinking about a gypsy. They just sort of say these things. And you often hear the same thing with people who use the words gay or f***. And their argument is, look, that's just a word. It doesn't really mean homosexuality. And there was this story that came up here in Utah recently. There was this young woman at a BYU football game a couple of weeks ago, and she has this sign. They're playing Mississippi State, I think it was Mississippi State. And she has this sign that says, you can't spell Mississippi without sissy. And a local newspaper columnist, the film and TV critic, he called her out. And it sparked a lot of reaction. People were saying, hey, come on, you're overdoing it. It doesn't really mean that. What do you make of something like that?
Well, unless I'm mistaken, you can, right? Because there's a Y in sissy.
I know you
sissy,
can.
But
it didn't make any sense. So true. But still, to the bigger point.
Yeah, to the larger point, it is certainly the case that a public dialogue about terms that denigrate is valuable, mm-hmm. right? It is an airing of opinions. I think that what's problematic is that people continue to have knee-jerk reactions in both directions. So we see this now with the case of Redskins, you know, the professional football team, and should it be allowed to continue to be the name of the Washington football team? Well, to have a public discourse is to potentially diffuse the power of the disagreement, right? If people, I think sissy is a hard one because I don't know that many people find that particularly offensive. But certainly for the words that you mentioned earlier, for gyp, for example, which mm-hmm. Roma people, with, you know, gypsy yep. people find offensive, use of the word f- not as a term for homosexuals per se, but just for as a general term of abuse for, you know, people to call someone weak or disempower them. Those terms do have effects on specific groups of people. And I think an airing of the effect can have the consequence of people being more careful in their selection of words. And we see that with the younger generation now who are not using tarred. They're shying away from it. They're shying away from faggot, which in the schoolyard of my childhood was just a general insult term.
Yeah, mine too.
So I think that having that conversation can change attitudes. But the sort of strident rhetoric of you can't say that word, or you can't tell me what word I can say, that's not as productive.
Which I guess leads us finally to this. You say people, of course, have a legal right to say these words. It probably doesn't do any good to try to censor or ban these words. But if you know that words do harm, then you should be tolerant and aware. Sort of self-determination, I think. Linguistic self-determination, I think, is how you put it. Maybe say something about that, if you would, finally.
Well, I guess my take on words is that they're tools, and they do things. And sometimes the ways that we use them cause harm to other people. We live in a free society where we all get to choose our own actions, and we like to believe that we decide to act responsibly. And what that means, I think, usually is that we exercise our freedoms exactly up until the point where it causes harm to someone else. My right to swing my fist ends at your nose, as someone famously said, but we don't actually know who. often misattributed.
Yeah.
So with words, I think it's the same thing, not just with profanity. I mean, a lot of the discourse about bullying and hate speech versus kind treatment of other people that we see nowadays in childhood education and in parenting is exactly about this idea. It's about the idea that you can decide to do whatever you want. But when the things that you want to do cause harm to other people, maybe take a second and think about why you're doing them and think about the social effects of the things that you're doing. And I like to think of that as a general rule of thumb for not just language in general, not just action in general, but for profanity in particular. I choose not to use profane words in those circumstances in which I think that they'll harm someone. If I think that my grandmother is going to be really upset about this particular four-letter word, even though I don't mind it at all, and I don't think that it's going to cause psychic harm to anyone who hears it, if she believes that, then I'm going to make the choice to not use it around her. And I think that teaching children that there are choices they can make that are more or less respectful of other people's well-being, more or less respectful of other people's wishes, and to maybe lean towards the more respectful side, I think that's the best gift that we can give them.
Benjamin Bergen is a professor of cognitive science at the University of California, San Diego. His book is What the F? What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, and Ourselves. Radio West is a production of KUER News. All the curse words were bleeped by Benjamin Bombard, who produces the show, along with Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.